This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the final event of day three of the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival in its third year here at Destinations, please welcome Paul Blessard and John Holmes.
Hello.
You in there?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, weary travellers, how are you doing? You had a good festival? Good show? Booked your holiday? Who's going on a cruise? Nope. Who's not going to the States because the ESTA online visa application is such a pain in the arse since Trump took over? Sorry, very vulgar. You're not going, exactly. Boycott the US. Actually, you can't. It's too big. It's too nice. Now, John Holmes, how many here listen to Radio 4? Excellent. You're in the right place, and more importantly, so's John. How many here listen to talk radio? Good people.
Look at that. There we go. That's almost rivaling Radio 4 right there, isn't it?
Exactly.
Look at that.
We're going to talk about two things, because those of you that know John Holmes, especially Radio 4 listeners, know him for his fantastic contribution to the news quiz.
Now show.
Forgive me. With everybody from Mitch Benn to goodness knows who, Marcus Brigstocke. But what he's so we're going to talk a little bit about John's fantastic book, which is a superb sort of coming-of-age memoir of him growing up and his background and his history and what fascinates him. And it's really beautifully written. I commend it to you. He'll be signing it afterwards. But those of you who read the Sunday Times, anybody here read the Sunday Times? Not so many. He's also a brilliant travel writer for the Sunday Times, so we're going to talk about that in amongst other things. So probably the best starting point is, how did somebody known for radio comedy, for being a radio voice, being a radio presenter, for being all the many talented things that you do, transition to becoming a travel writer for such an august publication as the Sunday Times?
It was a complete accident, and it was one of those phone calls that sort of comes out of nowhere, and I'd written not this book, but a previous one, and the then travel editor of the Sunday Times had either read it or bits of it or something, and it was a kind of it was about rock and roll myths and legends, so it was, wasn't War and Peace or anything, but it was a phone call, and it said, "Oh look, I quite like your writing. Would you fancy writing travel?" To which, of course, the answer is yes. I would like to do that.
Yes, please.
Immediately. And the first job I got, they said, "Well, we're going to just test you out." So there's a hotel in Amsterdam, which is like, it's where they send the waiters, waitresses, kitchen staff, reception staff for hotels, five-star hotels around the world, to train. It's like Top Gun for waiters, is what it is. And they said, go and review it. And because you can pay to go there, and the idea is it gets more expensive through the year, depending on how good. If you go at the beginning of the course, that these the kids are basically training, they're rubbish, and they will spill soup on you. If you go at the end, they're all completely trained, and therefore it's more expensive. Anyway, so I went to review it, just wrote funny things about it, I think. And after that, it was just goes, okay, where do you want to go next? Which, again, is just a fantastic...
I kind of want to go to this hotel. What's it called?
I can't remember now.
Okay, you don't.
But, you know, Google it.
You can Google it, exactly. So that was the first piece you wrote. That got you the gig. Where did they send you next? Once you'd proved your... you'd done your
training. I made the mistake. They sort of said, I think they said, what are you frightened of? Was the next thing. And I fell for that. And went, one of the things I would never do is even though I like the idea, is learn to dive. That freaked me out. And they went, right, you're off to learn to dive. Go on. And I went to
Egypt.
That's right. I don't know whether everyone is a diver, but you obviously do when you start, you do a pool course to learn the basics before they then throw you into the open water. And there's like a 6-week pool course, which I did in a weekend,
right.
Pretty intensely. And then for the second part of the qualification, I got thrown off the back of a boat in the Red Sea. And on the day I qualified, there's a World War II wreck called the Thistlegore, which is incredible. It's one of the top 10 dive sites in the world, and it's a World War II battleship that sank, fully laden with tanks and jeeps and motorbikes, and it's a museum, and all this is still there. And it just went straight down with all this stuff still on it, and you can go down and swim through it and stand on the deck and stuff. So, and it's quite a hard dive because of the currents and everything else. And so on day one, I was standing on the deck of this ship, scared out of my mind.
Good God.
And I remember swimming through the captain's cabin, with the dive master, and his shaving stuff is still in the sink. And stuff. You know, wow. You can sort of see all this. Absolutely incredible. And I was terrified, but I loved it so much that I've been obviously diving many times since. And
you did the dive successfully, nothing went wrong.
Yeah, and then I wrote about the experience in the Sunday Times, which prompted a sort of backlash from the diving community going, what was this idiot novice doing standing on the deck of the Thistlegorm? That's one of the most dangerous dives. What sort of idiot would let him do that? So, I'm an idiot. That's how it works.
I'm always intrigued to know how it works with travel writers, because everybody seems to have a different path. Some people submit proposals to the travel editor, and the travel editor says, well, sure, you can go there, but we're not going to pay for it. Why don't you do it and write about it? And if we like it, maybe we'll pay you some money. And sometimes the travel editor say, what are you frightened of, or what have you not done? And they will come up with an idea and send you to other places. How does that work with you?
It's a mixture of both. And because I do the radio... I can't do travel writing nearly as much as I'd like to do, and I'd like to, do that a lot more. Who wouldn't? That's why we're here. We like travelling. So to be, paid essentially to go and write about something is a fantastic gift. I'm very grateful for it. And it's a mixture. Sometimes I'll go, I'd like to do this to the editor, and they'll sort of go, well, no, because that's too expensive. That happens. And also, you've got to tailor it for the audience. The Sunday Times readers. Know what they want to do, they know what they like, and they know an angle. You've got to have a story attached to it, you've got to learn something. And it can be, there was a company called Kid & Co, I think, who specialise in houses and apartments around the world, which they say are perfectly child-friendly. Okay, that's their shtick. And they said, okay, this is their thing, child-friendly houses. Right. How old are your children? And they, at the time, were sort of, 4 and 2. Right, go to one of them in the Cotswolds, and see if they break it or it breaks them. And so we went for the weekend, and I remember we walked into this house, and it was actually the bass player of Coldplay's wife's house, right? And she obviously lets it out. That's why. Anyway, we walked in, and it was all Cotswold stone and flagstones and edges and steps and bits of metal and art and stuffed owls. And my wife just walked in and just took one look at it and just sort of went, nope, no way. And it was like, in Sherlock, when he sort of goes into a room and all of that information comes up. I could see her doing that. Yes. Just going, right, there's a step there. That's dangerous. That'll break. No, that's going to have sick on it by the end of the day. And it was all of that going on. But, of course, that was the point. It was road test this house.
And you got to write a piece about it.
Nobody died.
Nobody died. That's good. Oh, good. Yeah. Now, listen, I want to talk to you about one thing, because you've done a few tropical sort of exotic locations, but you've also been to a place I'm fascinated by but have not been to, which is Papua New Guinea, or PNG as people call it.
Yes.
Tell us about your Papua New Guinea experiences.
It's quite a weird place. Obviously, it takes a very long time to get to Papua New Guinea from here. Hi there. But it's a really weird place because it has this... Well, it was only the middle of Papua New Guinea was only discovered in like 1932. Right before that, nobody knew anybody lived there, and as a result, it's the Stone Age, and time has not affected the centre of Papua New Guinea. And the deeper you go in, the more tribal and Stone Age it is. And I think Port Moresby, the capital, is the most lawless city that's not a war zone, I think, statistically speaking. So that's interesting when you land at 4 a.m. and you've got to get to the domestic terminal, and all of the advice you've been given is do not leave the terminal. And you go, yeah, but I've got to walk 0.5 mile to the next one, and it's 4 a.m. Don't go outside. I've got to get over there. Don't do it. But I've got to. Anyway, so that's when you arrive. And then you are on a number of flights. And by this time, you've been travelling for 30-odd hours. And a number of flights in decreasing sizes of plane get you into the middle, and then you're on boats, and then you find yourself, well, as I did, in a dugout canoe with two tribesmen crocodile hunting, because they trade the skin and they eat the meat. That's what they do. And what I learned from that was that if you spear a crocodile through the skull, it screams quite loudly. And then they would drag it into the boat with it thrashing around.
Good God.
Sit on it and then, tie its snout up so it doesn't... And then they skin it. And it's incredible because they've no idea about the outside world. It's totally alien to them. And right. I had an armed guard and stuff. Not because I was in particular danger from them, but they have tribal wars about land. all the time.
Sure.
And it's all about if a man from a tribe sleeps with a woman from another tribe, there's a war. And they're constantly at war. And I was lucky enough to sit in a spirit hut, which, you know, outsiders aren't normally allowed into.
So what's a spirit hut?
So it's where they go to make decisions. So the spirits will tell them what to do.
Okay.
And each village has this. And they're the two tribes, to decide whether or not to be two tribes who literally go to war, they consult the spirit drum. And the spirits in the drum tell them whose land that is. And I watched them having this big argument as the spirits were supposedly telling them how to do it. And it's just fascinating because there's nothing modern about it at all. You know, they hunt with bows and arrows. Education's starting to come in. You know, so missionaries did go in there once it was discovered. Right. So you've got all that going on. So there's a clash of religions. They believe in sorcery completely. I mean, that things come out of the jungles at night to drag their children away. They don't let children go in caves. They certainly don't let them go to the jungle at night. And until, I think it was the 1970s, black magic was a defence in murder cases.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they had a belief that people could attack you with black magic so you could kill them. And that was they were going to put a spell on me so I killed them. Oh, that's fine then. So sorcery is a huge part of their lives, and it's absolutely eye-opening. I mean, it's nothing like you've ever seen. I was talking to a helicopter pilot. His job was to put mobile phone masts across the country, because obviously technology starts to happen. And he's permanently employed. He takes a crew of engineers in, and he's permanently employed to land the helicopter, keep it running while the engineers assess the damage done to their transmitters by tribes,
because
they just tear them down and throw them off cliffs. And he has to keep them, because he knows what will happen. They'll just attack the helicopter, and he's had the classic Indiana Jones stuff where they've been throwing spears at the helicopter as he takes off and all this kind of stuff. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. Well,
but you're writing this for the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
And the point of doing travel journalism, travel writing of this style, is to open up for people like the people that come to this festival. So why would they go?
Well, PNG Tourism are here actually as well, that's the thing. It's a case of, you know, all corners of the world are fascinated for different reasons.
Sure.
Why, you know, do it right and with the right people, you haven't really got anything to be frightened of. And that's good because it's breaking down those barriers of time. It's just unlike anywhere I've ever been.
Would you recommend it?
I would recommend it. It's not 2 weeks in the sun lying down. It's quite adventurous. You know, you are in the middle of nowhere, but you are on the Sepik River. There's a boat, which it was part of the point of the trip. It's this new route in. Where tourists can now go and sort of live
from
on a boat.
From Port Moresby into the interior.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, right.
So,
but anybody here been to Papua New Guinea? Anybody thinking now about going to Papua New Guinea?
Honestly,
exactly.
It's fantastic.
There we go.
Yeah, there you
superb.
Go. Sold.
Yeah, done. What would you recommend taking to Papua New Guinea? Some people are quite fetishistic about the things that they take on their travels, whether it has to be a mosquito net or a head torch or...
Well, because of the getting around, because of the you know, you're in Cessnas, so you're lugging, you can't take any more than 10 kilograms. So, you know, that's quite hard. You've got to be quite...
You have to be very
especially with a load of camera gear and lenses as well. That was recording gear, but it was...
Cool.
Yeah, but, yeah, I recommend it.
Not so long ago, you've come back from a place which is very dear to my heart in Central East Africa, which is Rwanda.
Yeah.
Tell us what you were doing there.
Making a documentary. Gorillas, essentially, in the wild. Rwanda, as you know, but it's another fascinating place because of its recent genocide history. I mean, that's, you know, we're talking 20-odd years ago.
94.
So everyone you meet in Rwanda is touched by that genocide. So from the waiters in your hotel or your lodge to the chefs, you know, you just... And again, the advice about travel is... Go and talk to real people. You know, don't just talk to your guides. Just go and talk to proper people who live there. And when you do that in Rwanda, the stories you hear are heartbreaking, because you know they bore witness to their families and siblings being killed in front of them in this horrific genocide. So there's that side of the country, but then of course there's the wildlife, and the wildlife is a passion of mine anyway. So I was there to go to track gorillas. So we went up into the mountains, into the Volcanoes National Park. Accidentally crossed over the border into the Congo at one point, at which point our armed guard hustled us back quite quickly to find gorillas. And how hard is it to find gorillas? And the answer is, well, it changes because they move a lot.
Right.
And you're only allowed 7 people into the national park at once as well, so it's very tightly controlled. But when you find yourself sitting like David Attenborough did that time with 23 gorillas with babies... and just sitting down with them for an hour, because that's all you're allowed with them as well. It's very... Again, absolutely amazing, because they have no fear of you. They've got no reason to fear you. Now, guerrillas obviously are poached and it's terrible. In Rwanda, not so much. Certainly across the border they are. But it's they've just got no fear of humans at all. And you know, they're the closest relative to us and all that kind of stuff. And when you stare into their eyes, and you're not... Technically, the rule is you don't go near them. You sit near them, but there's a 7-metre rule, I think, sure. It is, where, you know, so you don't go and pet them. They don't know about that rule, so they will come and sit on you quite a lot. And at one point, I was trying to take a photograph. I was recording for this documentary, as I was saying. So I got some recording gear, and I was trying to take a photograph and hadn't really noticed I was in the way of a rather large gorilla. There you go. As I looked up, the gorilla was sort of ambling in my direction, but just to get past me, just to get, you know, to some food behind me or something. I will tell you that being shoved fully in the chest by a fully grown gorilla and pushed over is quite something. But it wasn't aggressive. It was just like, get out of the way.
Were you frightened? Did you feel...
My heart started racing quite a bit.
These are 300-pound
yeah.
lumps of meat.
They are
with
very,
a lot of
very, very big creature. And then when we were lucky enough on day two to find two rival gorilla groups, and so they were fighting for territory, but in displays of aggression without actually, you know, hurting it. But they will go, you know, they'll go at each other.
Has anybody here been to Rwanda? I know you're an adventurous lot here. Have you been to Virunga National Park? For those of you that haven't, can I suggest, I'm sort of active with Virunga, so John's talking about something that's very passionate to me, because I spend a lot of time in Rwanda. There is a fantastic website for the Virunga National Park, and you can make a contribution. I don't know if any of you were here with me talking to Simon Reeve yesterday or the day before, but it's where you get to see how you spend your tourist money actually being used to facilitate the very thing that you have come to see. And Simon often says, you know, when you pay your entrance to a wildlife park or a game reserve or something, you think, oh, it's just going to sort of support somebody who's living the high life. But no, in Virunga, that money goes straight into the petrol tanks of the jeeps and the land cruisers that are being run by the game wardens, who are genuinely risking their lives to protect the mountain gorillas, whose population is ever dwindling. Mm. And sadly, they lose, I mean, two or three guards at Virunga every year to poachers who are constantly... sort of, you know, aggressing into the park, trying to kill the gorillas for trophies. It's a terrible thing. So the Virunga National Park website, can I direct you there?
It's rare in travel as well as a place like that, because you're right, because you know that your tourist dollar is going directly to the people that need it and use it for good. You know, it's not going into the... You know, it's not a corrupt African nation.
No, absolutely.
That doesn't happen there. And that's rare, because when you think of Rwanda and its history, and also, you know, landlocked African countries, you sort of go, oh, okay. But it's not. It's very different to all the surrounding, you know, Ugandas and all of that.
And actually, if any of you watch movies on Netflix, there's a very good film called Virunga about the work of the park, which I'd also commend to you. So, okay, that's Papua New Guinea and Rwanda. Do you have a sort of bucket list of destinations that you're working way through? You're an inveterate traveller. Where do you have a burning desire to go to?
Yeah, I sort of don't, because I deliberately think if you do have a bucket list like that, you maybe are closing off other opportunities in a way. So I very much have that, I will go there. It's not just, will you go there? Yes.
Yes.
So I have no... You know, the word no does not come into it. You know, and even with diving, it was like, I don't want to do... Oh, yeah, come on.
Why
yeah,
not?
Why not?
Yes, exactly.
What's the worst that can happen? Oh, well, quite bad things, yeah. life's about experiences, isn't it? And you know, if you're lucky enough to be able to travel, always do it, wherever it is, I think. Because it's... And as I say, go and talk to... You know, one of the most rewarding travel experiences I ever had was on a day I was supposed to be going diving in... So there's an island off Puerto Rico called Vieques, which is a tiny, tiny little island. And I was down there reviewing that island, really, because it just opened up as a tourist destination. And the weather came in and rain came in, so I couldn't do anything that I was supposed to be planning. So I just went to sit for a walk along the beach and sat in a beach bar and met this guy, you know, 80 years old, lived there all his life, full of the most fascinating tales just of the area and of the island life. And we just got drunk on rum. And as travel experiences go, one of the best, because, you know, he had no agenda, he wasn't selling anything.
Quite.
This is just what I am and what I do, you know, and we just traded stories, and he was great.
So, and as wiser men of me have said, and wiser women than me have said, there are 6.5 billion destinations on this planet, and it's the people that you talk to when you travel, and the countries that you know, the places that you go to. You've travelled the States a little. Can we talk about America?
Yes. Well, a lot of that's some of the stories in the book. I tried to find. I don't know if you've heard of Area 51. You know, the secret base in Nevada where the aliens all get experimented on by. Well, Donald Trump now, probably, but although he's probably had them thrown out of the country.
Why did you want to go there? What led you to...
Well, because I just like the idea that, you know, Area 51 was a secret. It's one of those things I've always said, you know, if someone says don't do it, do it. Well,
try and go to a place that's meant not to exist.
Yeah, well, it's like Port Moresby. It's like, don't go outside. Got to go and go outside. You know, it's too hard. So, yeah, it's not supposed to be there. We all know it is. It's on Google Maps, for God's sake. So, but getting there is surprisingly difficult because, of course, it's 13 miles of dry riverbeds before you find... but what was amazing about it, because I'd read all these stories on UFO geeky websites going, well, there'll be black helicopters and guys with shotguns and trucks and they'll come and get it. I said, yeah, all right. Anyway, so... Me and my friend at the time, we just hired a car in Vegas, drove out there. It's like 80 miles north of Vegas, I think, near a town called Rachel. And sure enough, we got there and were intercepted by...
Along the way, you were told one major waypoint was to look for a white signpost.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Because it's a mailbox.
Mailbox,
that's really? Right. So the geeky UFO people go, if you look for the white mailbox, I mean, already it's X-Files territory, and turn left at it.
So that depends on which direction you're approaching it from.
Yeah. Well, Vegas probably is.
Exactly.
But there isn't a white mailbox. It's black now. I don't know what. So I did ask someone what had happened to it, and the guy who owned it had just painted it a different colour to confuse UFO people. I don't know. Anyway, you turn left this, but as you start going down this road that's not a proper road, you start realising that on the ridges above you, there's all this... sensor equipment and stuff just hidden in trees, and you thought this is very odd. And by the time you round a corner and there's a sign which many of you may have seen just in print because it's fairly well publicised now, just says any further than this we can shoot on site, use of deadly force authorised. So anyway, do not even photograph this sign kind of stuff. So out we get to photograph the sign, and as we do so, this truck appears above us with these guys properly cliched sunglasses and all that, guns, and just sat and watched us as we very sheepishly got back into our car. And a helicopter went over, and all of a sudden we drove back, you know, thinking this was music. And sure enough, there were patrol cars of the highways police waiting for us at the other end just to work, you know, ask us who we were, what we were doing, all this kind of stuff. So, you know, we'll be looking at the base. There isn't a base. Okay. It's all about the base. No.
There is no base.
Yeah.
Were they friendly? Were these friendly highway patrol, or were they...
They were all right. I got arrested once for speeding in Texas, right? And he wasn't so friendly. That was a proper... I mean, you know, again, travel experiences. Try and get arrested in Texas. It's really fun. And what they do is like in a film, they will bend you over the car, kick your legs apart, and frisk you while looking like something out of a movie. And it's, you know, all the while it was a bit nerve-wracking. It was brilliant.
And well, this is brilliant. Fun.
This is amazing. And he said, right, okay, so you're doing... when are you going home? And this was like the Monday, so, you know, and we were driving down to Houston, I think. And I said, Thursday. He went, No, the judge doesn't even get into town till Friday. I'm like, all right. And so he's like, this is jail time. So you're doing 115. There was no car on the right. I mean, yeah, we were just speed gunned from a long way off. And he said, right, you're going to go, you know, we're going to put you in jail in the nearest town. The judge will get by on Friday. You can't fly home. Anyway, this conversation went on a bit, passport, all this kind of stuff. And it happened to be my birthday, right? So, and he looks at the passport and he said it was his birthday. He went, yeah. And I could see him sort of weighing up the paperwork of this, you know, you could sort of, he was sort of, oh, do I need the, is this? And then he said, all right, open the trunk, you know, right, which was full of beer, right?
Of course.
I mean, in bottles. It wasn't just swishing.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And straw coming out. And you're not allowed to do that either. You have to, if you have beer in Texas in a car, it has to be sealed up.
Right.
And of course, it wasn't all sealed up how it should have been, and so he didn't like that. Anyway, in the end, he said, "Look, I'm going to let you off, but what you have to do is, you have to by Thursday, you have to go to a post office and pay a fine of $80 for this." Yep. Right. Fine. Okay, I'll do that. Anyway, got in the car, drove off. And I said to my friend, who'd sat terrified in the car the whole time, because guns had been involved, you know, in this. And he said, So you've got to pay this fine. Otherwise, you'll be a wanted felon in the state of Texas.
Right.
And I was like, that's the coolest thing. How good would it be to be wanted in Texas? So I got into the car and said to my friend, I'm not paying that fine. I'm just going to fly home. And then I'm going to be on their website.
And, there'll be wanted posters with your face on
them. Right. And then he rightly said, if you do that, you realise you'll never be allowed back into America. You won't be able to come here again. You know, like a Muslim. And I said, I waited up for a while. I thought, you know, that'll be cool to be on a website, being a wanted felon in the state of Texas, on the same website as Osama bin Laden, probably.
And Butch Cassidy.
Yeah, brilliant. And then I went to pay the fine.
And you are currently allowed back into the United States of America.
Yes, although I haven't tried since Trump. So
until your next infarction, exactly. Give us an idea. What do you think makes good travel writing? You have the pressure on you, when you've done trips like this, to tell us the experiences through print in the Sunday Times. Do you have any inkling, any idea, any insights as to what you consider to be the ingredients for a good travel article?
I think you just have to be sort of honest.
Right.
Really. I think readers, in whatever you write, can see through nonsense.
Yeah.
And again, it's about talking to people and getting their stories, and then it's your job to convey those stories. Costa Rica, and there was a sign, and I was, again, fairly in the middle of nowhere. I like going to the middle of nowhere, you know, I like that sense of solitude and isolation, and often, you know, with no phone signals and all that kind of stuff. And there was a lodge on this small bit of land, Costa Rica, and the sign said, do not go into the rainforest after dark. And so my guide rightly said, well, it's just getting dark. Let's go into the rainforest. Now, I'm not good with spiders.
Right.
But what I realised, of course, is that for a travel piece, this is exactly the sort of thing you need to be doing.
Course.
There's no point going sitting over there, you know, reading a book. What you need to be is in there when you're not supposed to be.
Right.
While, honestly, this guide, he was brilliant. He was one of the best guides I've had. Totally into his insects, wildlife, and all, you know, and poisonous frogs. And so we were there with torches. And he'd said to me when we go in, he said, well, don't make sure your torch points at the floor. If you point it up, every insect will come into your face. And some of them are the size of cats. So don't. I was like, oh, right. And I, not good. So that's fine. But of course, we're stopping every now and again and we're looking around, you know, at these tiny little tree frogs and insects the size of cats jumping over there. And he knew about my fear of spiders. So he'd done this on purpose. And he said, look, he said, if I just put my torch up now and just do that. And what I saw was just what looked like cat's eyes, as in the road cat's eyes, just glinting everywhere around me. I mean, thousands everywhere. And he went, that's spiders.
Good Lord.
Get me out of this forest now. but it was absolutely terrifying if you don't like spiders. And of course, there's great big orb weavers, and you've got to be careful not to walk into them with the webs or anything else. Anyway, he'd been doing this for years, okay? And we came across this spider. It was a big spider, and it was on a big leaf, okay? And he was pointing at it, and he's saying, okay, this is whatever spider it was at the time. And he was telling me all about it and how they hunt and the kind of stuff. And I'm sort of hated it, but was fascinated, as you are by these things. And as he was talking to me and pointing at the spider, it jumped onto his hand. I mean, it jumped from the leaf onto. And I have never seen a man crap himself quite as much as he did. Right? And he went, ah! Like that, and the spider jumped back. And he was like, in 20-odd years, that's never happened before in my life. And he said, and what it was doing, I was pointing at it, and it thought I was prey. It jumped to find out whether or not I was edible to it. I wasn't. It jumped back. He said, that's what it was doing, just to test me out. He said, but I've never had that before. And
good
I was like,
God.
I can't unsee that. That's the stuff of nightmares for me, that is.
Do you know Ranulf Fiennes? Do you know who Sir Ranulf Fiennes is? He has two major fears. He's an old pal of mine. One of them is a fear of heights. He's absolutely terrified of heights, which, given the amount of his climbing, you think is bonkers. But his biggest fear, and it's terminal with him, is spiders.
Yeah.
And if you ever get to meet him, ask him to tell you the wolf spider story, which will have you running for the door.
Well, that's the thing. Everywhere I go, I always sort of go, oh, do you want to go to Costa Rica? Yes. Google spiders of Costa Rica. and I've checked, you know, in Brazil, I was down in the Pantanal.
Yes.
Okay, and of course, Brazilian wandering spiders are the most poisonous spider. And there was we were on the edge of a river, and we were there to photograph jaguar. in Brazil, which again, just majestic creatures, you know, these amazing big cats. And again, put the work in, you know, you sit in, you're 9 hours sitting there waiting for them to appear, and when they do, it's just absolutely incredible. But there was a forest fire miles and miles away. You could see at night, you could see it burning on the horizon. But what was happening was, ahead of that fire, towards the river, was coming every slithery, crawly creature to get away from the fire.
Course.
And of course, the guides were saying, okay, when you walk back to your lodge at night from the mess hall, just be aware that these things are out there. And snakes and everything else. So that was pretty hairy, because there was a lot of that about. And the girl in the lodge next to me, next morning, she was up all night. She said, oh yeah, she said, there was a wandering spider on my wall last night. I just left it there. And I was like, you what? Well, I would have burned it down.
Changed
rooms.
Rather
than, yeah. But yeah, and it was still there in the morning. I went to have a look at it. I didn't like it much.
I mean, I've forgotten you've been to the Pantanal. Did you get to see a jaguar?
Yes.
So these eyes have seen a jaguar.
Yeah, and again, it's about the wildlife aspect. A very good friend of mine who is here, in fact, who I said hello to when we started, he was standing at the back, who's a travel photographer, who taught me all about travel photography. And so I've got very into that now. You know, I'm very into travel photography and wildlife photography. And we went swimming with whales in Sri Lanka.
Okay. What sort of whales?
Sperm whales was the idea. Right. So they come in February, March. They come in to breed just off the top of Sri Lanka, Trincomalee. And we were trying to photograph them underwater and GoPro them and all this kind of stuff. And that's another, you know, wildlife experiences like that. You know, you're in the water, and again, two people at once. And you can only go out with research vessels, because you can't just have tourists piling in with whales. You know, they're protected. And to be in the water with them as they're swimming around you is absolutely
amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And then a blue whale came in.
Oh, good heavens.
So I'm just there swimming. And of course, you're in, you know, thousands of feet of water. You've got no air. Thing on, you can't dive with them because the bubbles would freak them right out. So really,
just
you've just got some fins and a snorkel.
Yeah.
And then you realise you've been swimming for an hour or whatever it is. You know, it's pretty exhausting. And sperm whales, and mate, absolutely huge. There they are, right in front of you, so close enough to touch. You know, to coming, and you can hear them clicking and whistling and all this kind of stuff. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, came this thing, the size of this room.
Whale shark.
You know, down to that wall, blue whale. I mean, just
good God.
Fast, like a submarine. I mean, it came in, and it came for me. I could see it coming, and then it just went underneath me like that, and just as I was floating
good.
On top.
What an experience.
Just
it's funny you should say about scuba diving. Can I add a small anecdote?
Please.
In South Africa, some years ago, I was diving and to go and see, with some friends of mine, a whale shark. And you're not allowed, these days, you're not allowed to use scuba equipment whilst being anywhere near a whale shark for several reasons. But also because it becomes so hypnotic, you lose all track of time. You're near one of the biggest creatures on the planet, other than a blue whale, of course. And it's so hypnotic, swimming alongside it with one big fin, you lose all track of time. You can actually end up drowning yourself and running out of air just because you're very much in the moment.
I was because you're following them, because, you're just absolutely fascinated. So you sort of, as much as you can follow a blue whale, but, you know, as far as you can, till it goes down into the blue and you don't see it anymore. And then I sort of surfaced and realised I didn't know where the boat was. And so I started to panic. I was exhausted by that point. I was treading water, circling round, couldn't see the boat. Land is 20 miles away, you know, it's 20,000 metres or whatever, down to a trench. And, of course, the boat guides knew exactly where I was. They hadn't lost sight of me at all. But the truth is, I was turning around every time the swell was going up, so I just couldn't see it.
Yeah, quite.
But I thought, this is the end of it now.
That's
a bit of a moment.
But not a bad way to go, actually.
Not a bad way. Saw a blue whale. Fine.
We have somewhere a man with a microphone who is going to be amongst you if you'd like to ask your own questions of John, whether about comedy or broadcasting or travel writing or being from Nuneaton.
Hello. Thanks. I'm just wondering, we've had a tradition lately, which you're now obviously a part of people famous in one walk of life coming into travel, writing and broadcasting. I mean, Michael Palin's actually got a whole new career out of it. There's a certain well-known cabinet minister with his Bradshaw under his arm. And you've obviously, you're legitimate, you're working for the Sunday Times and things like that. But there seems to be an increasing trend for celebs doing one-off gigs for the media, especially for television, getting sent somewhere and doing a pieces.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I wondered what your take on all that
is. Are you stealing jobs from proper travel writers?
Well, yes, probably. I mean, I wish I was a celeb and they'd let me do that, I'll be honest. I wish I was Joanna Lumley. No, you're absolutely right. I think, and again, it's all about selling it, isn't it? It's all about the big names. That's what they do with the TV thing, certainly. You know, no one's particularly interested in Martin Clunes on a train, possibly, but it's Martin Clunes. People like him. So let's put him on a train and people will watch it. That's what it is, really, I guess. And there is a trend for it. I don't know. I don't have a problem with that necessarily, as long as they can do it. And I think it becomes very clear when they can't. But it is always nice to see people with a passion for something following it rather than being parachuted in, as you say some people possibly are. But I guess, as I was saying about being honest, I suppose it's about if you present in an honest way or write in an honest way. I mean, you've got to be able to convey, you know, with a Rwanda documentary, it's for radio, so I had to do it in words, you know, and I'm crouched down next to a gorilla, which is eating mountain celery, showing a microphone next to the gorilla, you know, and to hear it chewing all the time, trying to describe the scene of what you're doing. But because I've got a passion for that kind of thing, it's sort of all right. Whereas I don't think if you weren't interested and were just doing it because whoever is a celeb, then it wouldn't come across. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, what do you have are you against it particularly? If
well, I would just say that I had no time at all for that certain cabinet minister. Yes. While he was a cabinet minister, but I have found some of it because he's obviously a complete anorak.
Yeah.
Where it comes
to. Well, that's the passion railways. He has, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's been quite interesting watching him sometimes, and especially on journeys that you know yourself. You know, I think that's the thing.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's the really best point, that it starts with someone having a passion for the thing that they're either doing or witnessing. So whether it's a passion for wildlife or plants or trees or trains or whatever, that's kind of where it starts from. Whether somebody's presenting something on TV or radio or whether they're writing about it. Because if they're not interested in the subject, and they try to synthesize it, you see through them, you know.
You see them
for the frauds that they are. Please, yes, sorry.
Hello there.
Hi.
I just wondered when we can see and where we can see your documentary on Rwanda.
It will be, so I do a daily show on Talk Radio, which launched last March, sister station to Virgin Radio and Talk Sports, owned by the same company. I do weekday afternoons. It's going to be broadcast at a weekend. We haven't got a transmission date yet, but hopefully later this month, early next month, I would think.
But just so we're clear, it's a radio documentary, not a TV documentary.
Yes, it's radio, yeah.
So as John just described, he was there in front of a silverback mountain gorilla with a microphone right by the gorilla's mouth.
So the commercial radio, because it's a commercial radio station, has never done this kind of thing before.
Quite.
So I wanted to sort of try and to see if we could do it, really. And obviously we've seen gorillas, famously with David Attenborough, on many documentaries, but to actually sit and do it in words, I kind of found a little bit of a challenge that I wanted to try. So, I think it's worked. I mean, it's not quite finished, but...
Well, it's putting to the test, actually. It's a very brave move on your part. I have to say I commend you, because it's putting to test the thing that everybody thinks about radio, which is where the pictures are so good.
Yeah.
But to describe on radio something that is so visual as being in Virunga National Park with mountain gorillas, that's a good experiment. Good on you. Do we have a question here, lady at the front. Are you feeling better now?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Could you point the microphone at your mouth like this? Hold it horizontally and it works much better. Thank you.
John, can you tell us about your encounter with Mrs. Thatcher or close encounter with Mrs. Thatcher?
I can tell you about my encounter with Mrs. Thatcher.
You're still on wildlife.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Yes, well, again, this is a story from the book, but Lord Ashcroft, a Tory donor, former chairman of the Conservative Party, had a 60th birthday party, which was held in the great room at the Grosvenor House Hotel on Park Lane. And I wasn't invited, let's be clear. But what happened was, someone I was working with at the time was... They'd thrown money at his 60th birthday party. So Lulu was performing, Cliff Richard performed, Tom Jones flew in from Vegas with his show band, Denise Van Outen jumped out of a cake. It was quite a strange night. And I was there because we'd written a bespoke script to take the mick out of the Tory party, who were all there, of course, all of the grandees, including Thatcher and all the rest of that, having dinner, and it was his birthday. And it's, cut a long story short, that all went fine, OK? And then I got quite drunk. and found myself sort of, oh, look, there's John Major. I'll go and sit with him. And I ended up just finding myself on a table with you know, people I used to watch on Spitting Image, or ex-cabinet ministers, you know, your Douglas Hurds, all this lot. And because I was drunk, I just decided to sort of tell them what I thought. And I don't remember a lot of it. What I do remember is being removed by security from the vicinity of Mrs. Thatcher and...
John Major.
And the rest of them, yeah. I think I asked John Major about Edwina Curry at one point. That didn't go so well, but if you recall that affair. It goes into a lot of detail in there about what happened, but essentially, yeah, that happened. Yeah, good.
How do you feel after an experience like that? Do you wake up the next morning and think, oh my God, what have I done?
Yes,
think,
I really did.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I did.
No, it was a bit of, oh my God, I didn't get an invitation to be 61st, let's put it that way.
Yes, no, exactly.
That didn't happen.
I have a small confession. I know John Major quite well, and I did an event with him at the Blenheim Palace Literary Festival not so long ago. Having already read your book, he remembers that event. another
okay.
question, please. He didn't say to say hello.
No, I wonder why.
Please, sir.
Hi. On the radio, on a talk radio show a few months ago, you told us a story about when a paid intern, Cornelius, went to ask Chris Morris to do something. Was that actually true?
This is a reference to, I used to do a show on XFM in London, which is now Radio X. Chris Moyles came in to do breakfast and was slightly unpleasant to an intern. That's the gist of the story. But yes, it did happen. Just to answer your very detailed and niche question there, yes, it did.
So Moyles was unpleasant to you?
Not particularly. It was just unpleasant to an intern. But the intern told the story on air, you see.
Oh, I see, right. Okay, fine.
That was
okay.
But obviously
you might want to buy John's book and have a chat with him at the signing tent afterwards if you want to get that deeper. Any more questions on travel writing, travel journalism, destinations?
I've got just one thing I would tell you, which is travel related, but it's not my travel story, but it sort of is, which will become very clear. So Hugh Dennis off of The Now Show and Outnumbered and stuff, and as what you were saying, he got asked to go and do a travel program or series of them where he would go somewhere and be Hugh Dennis in a place, okay? He was... I can't quite remember the place. It was like the Himalayas. It was somewhere quite remote. And right. He was with a film crew making this programme. And they trekked for quite a way, and they'd gone up a mountain, and they were going to meet a hermit at the top of this mountain. Okay. And it took them a couple of days to get there, I think. And they found this hermit, and this hermit had agreed that, you know, someone had set up an interview to talk about this man's life or whatever it was. And anyway, so they go in to meet him, and he said, "Oh, I'm Hugh Dennis. Nice to meet you. Thanks for doing this kind of thing." And this guy who essentially hadn't had human company for quite a long time, and sort of eschewed the modern world, said, "Hugh Dennis from the radio."
What?
And he got a radio, this guy, in his hut. Right? He got a radio. And he went, "Hugh Dennis from the radio." I know who you are. I listen to your program, and you know I get it on World Service repeats. And all this. You go, okay, and wow, and said, you know, you're all the way up in this mountain, you know, and it's and you've heard that. And he said, "Yes, well, I've got one question for you. How tall, John Holmes?"
How extraordinary!
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Mind you, what a perfect
I get that
job.
A lot. There was one strange incident, but this was a recording of The Now Show, where at the end, I was asked by one of the ticket people, do you mind staying behind afterwards? Someone would like to meet you, right? And I said, oh, yeah, that's fine, of course, yeah, I don't know what it is. So I went back onto the stage, and at the front of the stage, there was a lady in a wheelchair with two of her relatives, and they'd come to see The Now Show. And she said, "Oh, this is, you know, my mother," and she just really, really wanted to say hello, wanted to meet you in the wheelchair. I said, "Okay, fine. Hi, how are you? Thanks for coming. It's great. You enjoy it, all this kind of stuff." She said, "Yes." She said, "Do you mind just standing there for a moment?" And I was, "Okay, this is interesting, right?" And then she just started to get up, right, out of the wheelchair, right? And it took, and they helped her, as you'd expect, because she couldn't stand on her own, she's in a wheelchair. And they helped her up, and she's struggling for quite a long time, to the point where it was not embarrassing, but it was just a bit, do I help? I don't know what to do. And I'm just like, this is awkward. I'm not quite sure to help her. Anyway, she did stand up and they helped her. And she just, well, if you stand up now, so she did this and she just went, uh-huh. Just like that. She wanted to know if she was taller than me or not. She was. But I helped a woman stand up out of a wheelchair. I'm proud of that. I'm like Jesus.
That's a nice Monty Python moment.
Yeah.
The ex-leper.
It was very good. But the fact that she bothered to do that. Yeah.
Last question for me then. Do you know where you're going next? Or actually, given where you've been and have the options open to you, where do you choose to go on a holiday?
That's a good question as well, actually. Well, because I only get a limited amount of time to go anywhere.
Right.
I tend to have to use the holiday time to go and do these things
a
lot of the time. So it varies. And in terms of where next, I don't know. I really want to get, I haven't even got one in the diary at the moment. I'm getting very travel itchy about the whole thing. So, and I am freelance, so I can write for anyone. But I do, I need to get something in the diary and pitch something. No later than March, because, if you do like travelling, as I'm sure we all do, that's why we're here, you realise you do have to go away on a regular basis.
Exactly. Yes. Not by mistake, John and I met the editor of Wanderlust magazine earlier on at the Green Room. Both of us asked for her card so we could try and pitch ideas to her to get ourselves away. We have to wrap up there. John will be signing, I think, certainly this book, possibly another, or is it just this one?
There's two over there, I noticed.
There's two over there. Do go and have a chat with him. This is a superb and very honest memoir of a young man's growing up, and if he's rather interesting origins. You've been a fantastic audience. If you're coming back tomorrow, we'll see you then. Hope you have a fantastic time travelling this year. But thank you to this man, the giant that is John Holmes.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.